interesting that you finish with the work that Fiona's put into this sermon.
Really?
Yeah, because I've been, I'm not going to do my introduction. So I would rip up the first page, but the first page actually has some stuff on it I need to pick up on. How many of you believe that every good opportunity is a God opportunity? Every good opportunity is a God opportunity. This is when I rip up the first page. I want to suggest no. So when I was 18, part of Westport Apostolic represent, I got accepted into YWAM. And I was going to go to Bangladesh for 6 months, I think it was, to help paint a building there. And I really believed this was a God opportunity, because I had, you know, a lot of teenagers get a lot of words over them, and I was one of those teenagers that would, whenever we had a guest speaker, they would always have a word for me, and the word was quite consistent, that God had good plans for me, that God, you know, it's a typical word that you get. So YWAM, good, God, you know, God, just take the one O out, becomes God, simple as that. So it was definitely God, I thought. 2 months later, no YWAM, I had lead poisoning. So the doctor required me to stay in Westport for at least a year. And I felt that God had let me down by taking his opportunity away. I never, ever went on that YWAM trip because my faith slipped. After all, YWAM must be a God opportunity. I decided at that point that I'd run away from Westport, and that's how I ended up in Wellington. I was running away from both Westport and God. And then Vineyard represent. I happened to go to Vineyard Church one day, and there was a word there. It wasn't God wanted something good. It was one of Matt and I's friends said, there's someone in this church today that finds themselves with God in worship. God is calling you back to worship. And that was for me, that word. They didn't know it at the time, but that was for me, and I was back with God. So, one thing that I did learn, though, from the YWAM thing, is that when God's got a word for you, there's another word that comes after, and that's wait. W-A-I-T. Wait. Okay? So, waiting later. I'm a little bit more grounded in God, and that's going to be a very important word, grounded. And I'm working as a public servant here. I'm living in Wainuiomata. This is quite recent, about five years ago. Well, it'd be five, actually, come to think of it. It was announced government policy that they would merge all the polytechs together. So 2 years ago, I lost my job. 2 years ago, I got offered a new job. New government. 1 year ago, this time 1 year ago, I got a letter saying, that job that was offered to you, it no longer exists. You can take that job, you can take that opportunity, and it was a good one. This job was like my dream job. I actually thought this was the God moment in my life. Because this job was about helping young people who were broken re-engage with education. And I love making a difference. And so I was like, God, this is the job. And it also came with double the pay packet. So I got this letter, this job won't exist, but because we offered it to you, we legally have to keep the offer on the table. You can take the job, and we can't guarantee what your future is, or you can go back to your old job, which will be temporary. I wrote a very emotional letter. I got advice, because I've also learned it's also good to have good advisors. And that advice was, keep your emotions to yourself, Fiona. Press into God. So I went back to my old job. Again, you've got a new government, as you know. Tuesday this week, our CEO had to have a really hard meeting with us. We've been instructed by our government to make millions in savings. Not thousands, millions. Friday this week, I'm called into my boss's office. You can expect a letter in the coming week. Your job will be disestablished. I have a God that tells me something really powerful. And if you've got a pen, you need to write this down. T. A U with a hat on top, with a little pull tie on top. T U R A N G A W A E W A E. That is a word. Tūranga waiwai. Tūranga waiwai. My God has taught me to wait firmly on the tūranga waiwai he has given me. There is a person in the Bible that many of us have a lot of respect for. His name is David. Like myself, I'm not saying I'm as good as David or I'm up there with David, but he was given a word over his life when he was a young man. In 1 Samuel chapter 16, we learn of this. The Lord said to Samuel the prophet, "How long will you mourn for Saul, the broken king? Since I've rejected him, fill your horn with oil and be on your way. I'm sending you to Jesse in Bethlehem. I have chosen one of his sons as king." Go on a few bits. And Saul makes his way there. Samuel makes his way there. And he invites Jesse to bring his sons. And Jesse brings his sons. And in the Bible, it was always the eldest comes first. So Eliab comes. And Samuel says, "Surely the Lord has anointed this one." But the Lord said to Samuel, "Do not consider his appearance or his height, for I've rejected him. The Lord does not look at the things people look at. People look at outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart." Then Jesse called Abinadab, and had him pass in front of Samuel. But Samuel said, "The Lord has not chosen this one either." Jesse then had Shammah pass by. But Samuel said, "Nor has the Lord chosen this one." Jesse had seven of his sons pass before Samuel. But Samuel said to him, "The Lord has not chosen these." So I asked Jesse, "Are these?" He asked Jesse, "Are these all the sons you have?" "They're still the youngest," Jesse said. "He's tending the sheep." Samuel said, "Send for him. We will not sit down until he arrives." So he sent for him and had him brought in. He was glowing with health and had a fine appearance and handsome features. And then the Lord said, "Rise and anoint him. He is the one." So Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the presence of his brothers. And on that day, the Spirit of the Lord came powerfully upon David. So we know David has had a word over him. He will be king. So you'd think that his kingship would start at that very moment. But no, God needed to prepare David through the most awkward of ways. Here's David, knowing that he will be the future king of Israel, now at war with Saul. Literally, from that point on, the two are fighting. Well, one is fighting. And this is not a children's book war. And you've probably heard me say it before, but I find it really awkward when we treat the Old Testament as a children's book. There is real blood in the Old Testament. This was a war in which Saul wanted nothing less but to have David dead. This war went on for years and would result in Saul losing his own son, and doubtless other casualties as well. So you would think that David would make the most of the opportunities God would give him to end the war. It's just logical. War is bad. Good, take a no out, is God. And there was two such opportunities. In chapter 24, Saul is in pursuit of David with 3,000 men. This is 24. We read from verse 3 that Saul needed to go to the toilet. There's even the toilet mentioned in the Old Testament. He came to sheep pens along the way. A cave was there, and Saul went in to relieve himself. David and his men were far back in the cave. The men said, "This is the day the Lord spoke of when he said to you, 'I will give the enemy into your hands for you to deal with as you wish.'" The Old Testament also has lots of stories where there are bad advisors. Then David crept up unnoticed and cut off a corner of Saul's robe. David could have killed Saul there and then. He had the opportunity. Afterward, he's just cut off a piece of material. Afterward, David was conscience-stricken for having cut off a corner of his robe. He said to his men, "The Lord forbid that I should do such a thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, or lay my hand on him, for he is the anointed of God." So one opportunity, and David just said, I'm just going to carry on. Second opportunity, chapter 26. Later on, Saul and his 3,000 men set out to capture David in the desert of Ziph. Oh, no, why did I put all these... there's lots of Hebrew here. David then said to Ahimelech, the Hittite, maybe that's Hittite and not Hebrew, and Ashbenah, son of Zeruiah, Joab, how many have problems reading the Old Testament with those words, eh? So we'll just call Zeruiah Joab's brother, because I can say Joab. "Who will go down to the camp with me to Saul?" "I will go," said Abishai. So David and Abishai went to the army by night, and there was Saul lying asleep inside the camp with a spear stuck into the ground next to his head. Abner and the soldiers were lying around with him. Abishai said to David, "Today God has delivered your enemy into your hands. Now let me pin him to the ground with one thrust of my spear." So here's a guy, if you're saying, "I'll kill him for him. If you're not going to kill him, I'll do it. I won't strike him twice." But David said to Abishai, "Don't destroy him. Who can lay a hand on God's anointed and be guiltless? As surely as the Lord lives," he said, "the Lord himself will strike him, or his time will come and he will die, or he'll go into battle and perish. But the Lord forbid that I should lay a hand on the Lord's anointed. Now get the spear and water jug that are near his head and let's go." So there you have it. Israel is under the rule of a king who has lost his way. David is anointed as king and finds himself at war with Saul. Saul sets out to kill David. Then two times, David is given the opportunity to kill Saul and step into the opportunity that God has promised. "I have promised you'll be king." And two times, David chooses not to take that opportunity. I don't know about you, but if I was Abishai, I would be thinking that David is both crazy and this war didn't need to go on like that. Just think on it. If I was the advisor there helping someone in war, I'd be actually going, "I don't know if I want to follow you, because you are unnecessarily making this war go on by refusing to kill the enemy." But David knew a very real truth. Not every opportunity is an opportunity from God. He also would understand deeply where his roots were. His roots were firmly embedded in God, and he would not let that go in any way. David knew his tūranga waiwai. Tūranga waiwai in English means a place to put your feet upon. But it is an important, it is important to understand that in te reo, the Māori language, it is a figurative language. It is not, this word means this. It means so much more. Meanings are so much more deeper. To say I have a tūranga waiwai now does not necessarily mean I have a stage to stand upon where I can speak. To have tūranga waiwai is when you have a deep and embedded foundation for your own identity. It is a space in which you feel empowered and essentially at home in yourself. To have a strong tūranga waiwai is to have a core to yourself and your being that is so steadfast that no adversary, no adventure, no opportunity will shake you from this foundation. And there is one thing about David and his rise to kingship in the Bible. David is a man who had tūranga waiwai. He knew his identity. He knew every aspect of his being were rooted in God. He knew it to such an extent that he held fast to it. He saw no reason to press ahead of God. He saw no reason to give up. He knew who he was and he knew where he stood. And when he failed, and he did at times, he would feel the fracturing of God's heart at the core of his being. He knew where his foundation was. And the question is, do we really know ourselves? Do we really, each of us, have a strong sense of our tūranga waiwai? Do we see, when life hits us with adventures, do we see these as affirming the glory of grace, glory and grace of God in our lives? When life hits us with adversities, do we see these as affirming our need for God and his mercy? When life hits us with opportunities, do we see these at moments of time in which we allow our God to show himself in our lives and our world? Part of the story I missed out was that I was actually offered a job last year. So I was offered a job in the middle of the year to be CEO, Chief Executive Officer, the boss of a Christian organisation in New Zealand. I didn't apply for it. I was shoulder tapped. But God had told me something. He told me two things. The first thing was wait. He hadn't stopped saying that to me since I was 18. The second thing was, I have asked you to accept the eldership of the church in Wainuiomata. If you take that job, you won't be able to do two things. Being the boss of a national organisation, whether it be Christian or not, is a big job. I know that I am in the position I'm in. I know that I have lost my job. Okay, I know that. I know that I'm in the position I'm in to be a testimony to my staff. They're going to see someone finish a job, go through all the process, maybe get another job out of it, because whenever they restructure, there's jobs that you can go for. They're going to see someone who can actually keep a smile on her face and come to work every day and care about them. That is when you've got tūranga waiwai. When you know where you are. Just because it was a Christian organisation last year that offered me the job doesn't mean it's a God opportunity. I actually feel more privileged being a Christian in a Crown entity than I do in having to be just in a Christian organisation every day. I'm walking with non-Christians day by day. All of us who walk alongside non-Christians day by day, we have such a great job. You know, because that's our ministry. Amen. Paul Royce has to walk alongside each of us. He's got this mirror of a Christian every day, you know. He's having to walk alongside Christians, and that's, you know, it's hard enough as it is. Anyway, I've gone back off track. But the key here is, it's about tūranga waiwai, and you just think, the way that David demonstrated his self and all of that turmoil to the men around him, that was a testimony. He has the chance to kill Saul twice. A real possibility. You know, Saul going to the toilet, and David is hiding, and instead of killing him, David takes a piece of his robe. So David has another chance in the dead of the night. Again, instead of killing Saul, he takes his weapon and water. In both incidences, what David is demonstrating is that Saul's life was really in his hands. He could have taken Saul's life. However, he also recognized something even more powerful. Both his life and the life of Saul were in God's hands. And it was God's divine authority to take life or give life, not David's. Both are stories of opportunity, but to those with David at the time, both are stories of missed opportunity. I believe this is why we find two similar stories. These stories do demonstrate moments of opportunity, but David doesn't take it. And part of me knows that many of us, even I, are often grabbing opportunities left, right, and centre because we believe falsely that every good opportunity is a God opportunity, when that is not so. God calls us to be in wisdom. When I got offered a job at one point, I came up the front. Tina, you actually said to me at the time, is this opportunity from God? So just because it was there didn't necessarily mean it was from God. When we walk this sort of walk of just going every opportunity is an opportunity from God, we're actually like a dandelion seed. We're blowing around in the wind. We bounce around everywhere. We finally stop somewhere, often being trapped in soil, rocks and rubbish. We fail to learn the important lesson of having turanga waiwai, a place to stand in God. We fail to understand that just because it's an opportunity doesn't mean it comes from God. And if our turanga waiwai is firmly implanted in God in the first place, the Spirit of God which dwells within all believers would raise a check. We would be discerning and only take the opportunities that God reveals in himself to us. And having his identity strongly implanted in God would keep David's heart and actions in check. David would have known, yes, this is an opportunity, but he also would know that to take matters into his own hands would be a deep sin against God. You see, when we jump ahead and seize opportunities because we know the outcomes will be inherently good for us, or just inherently good for our family, we are sinning. This is because we dethrone God in our lives. We're actually saying, God, stuff you, this is a good opportunity and I'm taking it. We're telling him that we know better. We're telling him that he doesn't know his job. We're essentially telling him that we're better than him. In this moment, let's not fool ourselves. We do have a sense of turanga waiwai. Our identity is firmly planted in ourselves and our own desires, not in God. And in this instance, we may feel that our foundations are firm. We think we are planted in rich soil. But in reality, the soil is full of corruption, sin, death, and darkness. We are positioning ourselves in this position with sin upon sin. God, I come first. This is a good opportunity. I'm taking it. I don't really want to listen to you. Our lives may seem positive in that we are opportunity takers, not breakers. But the foundation for our life poisons our very being. David's not a floating daffodil seed, nor is he firmly implanted in the poisoned soil of his own desire. David stands firm in God and his identity. He knows that taking the opportunity now would disestablish his foundations. He knows that to seize God's promise in his timing, not God's, would break his relationship with God. And he knew that the promise given to him by Samuel, Jonathan, and even Saul themselves were promises from God. He knew it. He also knew he had to be in relationship with God for that promise to come true. And to break that relationship would effectively make God's promise null and void. In a sense, David knew that he had to have faith in the promise keeper. And in a sense, he knew what faith is. Now, I don't know this dude, but he's got a very cool last name. His name is Elton Trueblood. He once said, and this is a really cool quote, "Faith is not belief without proof, but trust without reservation." Faith is not belief without proof. So it's not, I believe in God, but there's no proof of God. It's not that. It is actually, I trust God without reservation. I trust in his promises. And I think this definition is true and well suited to David. You see, many of us fall into the trap of finding proofs to justify our faith. Many of us. God, if you are true, you will. I remember as a six-year-old praying that prayer. God still answered it. The next prayer was, well, you've answered that prayer now, God. Now, if you are true, you will. So it just was prayer upon me, prayer. You know, there's many non-Christians that say, I'll believe in God if he shows himself, if he proves himself. But there's actually many Christians that actually believe it as well. They are searching for proofs all the time. David didn't believe in a God because God could prove himself. David just trusted God without reservation. This meant that David had to trust God right to the point of kingship. If God wanted him to be king, then David would simply trust in God and that would occur. He wouldn't push God for proof and he wouldn't seize the opportunity. He would focus on keeping his foundation, his turanga waiwai, strong. And this must have been hard. In both chapters 24 and 26, we hear that David had others with him. He had friends, advisors, colleagues. In both situations, he would be encouraged by these friends. Seize the moment. Take the opportunity. Carpe diem. After all, surely God has given the opportunity. In both situations, David's sense of turanga waiwai was so strong that he knew that he didn't have to push ahead to get into his future. He can stand firm in the presence, in the present, because he's standing with God. But what did David see when his foundation was with God? What did he see that his companions didn't? Now, this person I do know, it's a mathematician. Blaise Pascal, he once said, and this is another cool quote, "In faith, there is enough light for those who want to believe and enough shadows to blind those who don't." So in faith, there is enough light for those who want to believe and enough shadows to blind those who don't. David's foundation in God meant that he could see God in that situation. Even if he was having difficulty, he would be able to pick up his harp and worship God. He knew just how strongly God was there, and he kept himself grounded in that truth because he could see the light. But his companions focused on the shadows. They would encourage David, "Here is your moment to take matters into your own hand. Why trust in that light that you can see? Focus on the shadows. Focus on Saul lying on the floor who is out to kill you. And he just might. Focus on him and you'll have success in future leadership." And I think that shadow watching is a problem that we all have in our own walk. There are times that we look at the shadows in our own situations. When something punches us, someone passes away, you lose your job, you end up bankrupt. We focus on that shadow and not on the light. And there are times that we actually speak shadows into the lives of others. There are times that we might encourage others to seize an opportunity out of God's timing. I had people at the beginning of last year advise me to take the new job because even though it was going to be temporary, I would have a moment in time where my pay packet was double. And I refused to do that because I understand that I am being a testimony in my workplace. And that, to me, was unethical and unmoral, and to me was a misuse of taxpayer money because you would be paying me to do nothing for a year at double my salary. So sometimes we speak those shadows in. I think a classic book in the Bible that shows people speaking shadows is Job. Here's Job suffering away and his friends are trying to advise him. That's the type of thing I'm talking about when we as Christians try to bring the answers to people who are going through moments of grief. Let's just stand with them and pray into the light. And it comes down to this. To have an established turanga waiwai in God is to know your identity is with him to such a point that you want to glorify him in all that you do. To have an established turanga waiwai in God is to know that if God has placed a promise on your life, God's challenge to you is to allow God to fulfill that promise so that in the end, you can only say one thing. The only reason why I stand here today in this promise is because of my God. With my God, I know I have turanga waiwai. I have a place to stand. I have an identity. But most of all, I have him. That is the only reason why I stand here today. So a few years ago, I travelled back down to Westport, my hometown. And I was walking down a street, and that hit me. God has done so much good in my life. You know, it honestly is God that I'm here. It is God that meant that when I was 17, I was beaten up massively in my home by my sister. And my school photo the next day, the photographer tried to hide my face in that photo because it was so evident how beaten I was. That might sound terrible, but what that led to was me boarding in a family, Christian family home from the church. I got to see what a true mother and father are like. I would not have had that if it wasn't for me being a Christian. I would have ended up instead in the social welfare home in Westport. My church wrapped its arms around me. And that particular church had such an impact on my life. You know, I had every family in that church. It was a church that's very similar to ours. Didn't have a lot of children, and didn't have a lot of young people. But every family in that church, it didn't have a cafe either, which is really cool because every family in that church made it that they would invite me into their homes on different Sundays. So I got into so many Christian homes. Walking with the Sarah family, the family that I lived with, I got to see, like I say, real Christian parents. But I got to see the type of Christian parents that aren't perfect, that fight at home, that argue, that struggle with their faith. But every day they were trying to raise Christian kids. When I wanted to come to Wellington, I had to get onto a particular type of benefit. I wasn't eligible for it because of the student loans and allowances rules. My parents refused to give their income to the government, so I couldn't get the student loan and allowance. Mr. Sarah went and he advocated and he fought for me to get a loan and allowance. And the person at the social welfare broke into the computer system, basically, and changed my birth date so I could get it. But Mr. Sarah did that. What that meant was I got to go to teachers' college. If I didn't connect myself with a vineyard, I would have ended up in addiction. Because the one thing I learnt about cities is they have nightclubs, and Westport doesn't have nightclubs. And that Shortland Street and the social life that gets lived in Shortland Street is possible if you live in a city. So I was Shortland Streeting it out in Wellington. You know, Vineyard was the right church at the right time for me because it kicked me back into line. And it got me into music. I thought that God never ever had a partner for me. And at Vineyard, Eric and I connected. And Eric wasn't a Christian. So I thought that I couldn't have Eric because he wasn't a Christian. But he went to Alpha and he became a Christian. All of this is God in my life. You know, none of this is by my work. None of it. Even in the position I'm in now. Not the position of not having a job potentially, but in the position I have in my job. If it wasn't for a Christian leader actually saying, you have something to give to our organisation at a strategic level, I would never have applied for it because I have a problem. I don't think I'm good enough in my heart. And I've had to have people like yourself actually tell me I'm good enough. Now I know, as I said to her on Friday, whatever the future is, I have to have a part in that. You know, but God's going to direct me. And the key thing he has said to me from the age of 18 is wait. Get yourself planted in me. I am so pleased that I didn't go to YWAM. I wouldn't be here. God is good. Even when life is rough. I'm going to finish with something that David wrote himself. This is a really, this is something that we all know. But think about this not as a funeral psalm. Think about this as a life psalm. Okay? It's not something to be read at the end of life. It's something to be read every single day when you wake up and you're celebrating the good thing that you've woken up. Actually, I actually will this week. Every morning I'm going to read this psalm. The Lord is my shepherd. I will not be in need. He lets me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He restores my soul. He guides me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, oh, there's that word shadow, I will fear no evil. Oh, he's looking to the light, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You have anointed my head with oil. My cup overflows. Certainly goodness and faithfulness will follow me all the days of my life, and my dwelling will be in the house of the Lord forever. Lord, I just pray, Lord, that we as your people can know what it's like to have a firm turanga waiwai in you, Lord, a firm foundation in you, so that no matter where we walk in life, we know where we are planted. No matter where we go in life, we know where we are planted. Lord, guide us in the opportunities that you give us, but also direct us when the opportunity is not from you. Lord, help us journey with each other and advise each other in your wisdom. Lord, let us be a people that focus on the light of you rather than the shadows around us. And Lord, let us be a people who have a faith which is trust without reservation. Amen.